Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Thank you for joining us in this, the latest edition of the OI's podcast series. My name is David Ledesma, I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Michael Maiden, who's Director of the Gas and China Programmes at the OIS, and we're here to discuss the key messages that came out of the recent Sponsors China Energy Brief, and that addressed China's energy plans and macroeconomic realities. And this was published by the Institute for Sponsors in mid-April. Now, just to timestamp this recording, in an ever-changing market, we're recording this podcast on the morning of Tuesday, the 12th of April, 2022. Michal, welcome back to the OIS podcast series.
Great to be back, David.
Michal, you published an energy brief for sponsors of the OIS China programme, so I thought it'd be a good idea today if we share with our listeners some of the key messages from that April brief. To start with, you know, the current market turmoil and China invasion of Ukraine, you know, how is China viewing that situation? And is there a clear winner here? You know, picking up distressed cargoes of oil and gas? How's it going to play out, do you think?
I think there's a sort of perception in the market that, sort of as you alluded to, China is a clear winner here. It has rhetorically at least aligned itself with Russia, or at least not condemned Russia. And so that it will be really the beneficiary, that it will be able to pick up discounted cargoes of oil and gas. And I think the reality is a bit more complicated, both on the logistical front and just in terms of how China views the West as well. So, I mean, on the logistical front, yes, it can pick up more cargoes of oil at a discount. But even there, the financial sanctions and sanctions on SWIFT are leading some Chinese banks to be a bit more cautious. In terms of gas, you cannot reverse the flows of pipeline gas to Europe from Russia and shift them to Asia. So maybe a bit more LNG could go to China, but obviously Chinese buyers would have to pay up for it. So just on that level, it is a bit tricky for China to absorb all these volumes. There's also not that much demand going on in China right now because the economy has been a bit more muted than I think a lot of people had expected. I mean, Q1 was always going to be relatively weak. We've had the Winter Olympics and therefore industrial curtailments to ensure blue skies. But instead of a recovery in sort of March, we're now facing an outbreak of COVID in China and very severe lockdowns to tame that outbreak. And that's all been playing on actual demand for both oil and gas. And I think the last thing to mention here is that even though I think China probably views Russian actions as sort of somewhat justified by its security concerns, it will not go as far as to jeopardize its commercial interests, and it won't go as far as to expose Chinese companies to potential sanctions by the West. So again, it is leading to some caution, and there are a number of factors that are informing this caution in the near term.
Okay, you mentioned the kind of the macroeconomic situation. So what is actually driving that weakness, and what are the expectations, do you think, for oil and gas demand?
So it's, as we just mentioned, it was the Q1 Winter Olympics, industrial curtailments, and now it is the zero tolerance COVID policy. Now, it started off with some provinces wanting to take a slightly looser approach to the COVID restrictions and only partial lockdowns and trying to contain outbreaks by, you know, sort of sending people to sort of quarantine areas. But as we're also seeing in the West, these latest variants are sort of highly transmissible. And we've come to a point where Shanghai, a city of 26 million people, is under full lockdown. And the government seems to... The central government now seems to be stepping in and managing the crisis, perhaps in a show that Shanghai mismanaged it originally. That's filtering through to other provinces that had perhaps thought that they could take a lighter approach to COVID management, but are now actually shutting things down quite completely. Now, that means we've had the Qingming Festival, the Tomb Sweeping Festival in early April. Usually that's mobility and tourism. That hasn't happened. So all mobility or sort of mobility is down considerably year on year. Supply chains are once again impacted. Ports are operating at reduced capacity. And again, this caution, these concerns about the central government's response. And again, we have to remember we are in a year of a leadership transition. The Shanghai leadership, the Shanghai leader Li Qiang was slated to be a candidate to replace the current premier, Li Keqiang. That might not happen now. Now, of course, trying to do crystal ball gazing into Chinese politics is complicated at the best of times. It's very hard to see whether this jeopardizes, and it probably doesn't jeopardize the leadership transition, but it certainly complicates it if one of the sort of if leading candidates are seen as having mismanaged some of their COVID responses. And politically, it is challenging that, you know, up until now, China very much presented itself as having dealt with the outbreak and with COVID much better than the West. Now, does that still hold true? It's complicated. But if we go back to the economy, then, then spurring consumer demand and spurring consumption is going to be tricky when everybody is locked in. And again, supply chains are not keeping up.
I must admit, Annika, it always amazes when you kind of just drop the number, like, you know, the population of one city, Shanghai, is 26 million. It just makes us put a kind of reality check on, you know, the impact and changes in demand when something happens in just one city in China. But okay, but supposing we did get some kind of stimulus in the second half of the year, you know, where does that place, you know, China's other objective, which of course is their environmental policies?
So we do have these, I guess, two sides to the story this year. The government in March at their kind of annual, it's called the two sessions. It's the kind of parliamentary meeting where the government issues its work report. They issued a GDP growth target of 5.5% this year. Now, already in March, that was seen as quite an ambitious target. Now, with everything that's going on, it's looking extremely challenging. What we've already seen in the first quarter of the year, now running up into April, has weighed on oil and gas demand, right? We've seen reduced demand for, again, gasoline and the transport fuels. We've seen LNG flows into China weakening. Sort of, we've seen that subdued economic activity translating into oil and gas demand. Now, if the government wants to hit that 5.5% GDP growth target, it's going to have to stimulate the economy. And the longer this COVID-related downturn continues, the stronger the stimulus will have to be. Now, stimulus, as we mentioned just earlier, consumption-led recovery is hard to see when households are worried about their incomes and, you know, people in Shanghai are struggling to get basic groceries right now. It will have to be an infrastructure-heavy stimulus again, and those are traditionally steel, cement, the property sector, not conducive to environmental transformation, let's put it that way. So we're seeing this tension once again between stability and economic activity through heavy industry and the need to put China on a much more sustainable growth pattern through more stringent environmental policies.
And that, of course, is kind of that contradiction, isn't it, between short-term growth needs versus the kind of the long-term change. But what does the recently issued 14th five-year plan tell us about that contradiction?
It's a tricky one because the 14th five-year plan, we also have to bear in mind that this is a policy document that takes months, even years, to put together. So the 14th five-year plan wouldn't necessarily have been tweaked to in response to, certainly not the Russian invasion of Ukraine, maybe the energy crisis of last year. So, you know, maybe some specific targets would have been omitted, but these documents sort of have a life of their own. But what it already shows us is broader thinking about the energy system and some of these tensions between short-term growth and long-term sort of change. Some of the interesting things are that the 14th five-year plan really focuses on a system-wide transformation. It is called the 14th five-year plan for a modern energy system, whereas previous plans were just a five-year plan. And it really emphasizes this holistic transformation, digitization, system-wide reform, again, energy systems that are based on non-fossil fuels. And it feels like there are perhaps less numeric targets than there would have been in previous plans, and some of them are less ambitious. But that's not the focus, really. I think trying to look at the specific targets would miss the point that this is gearing up the Chinese energy system for a longer-term sustainable growth development. Having said that, it does focus a huge amount on energy security, on the need for resilience, flexibility, storage, prices, crisis prevention. It deals with both safety and security. And safety has been an issue that has long plagued the kind of energy system in China. It deals with both. But when you think about everything that's happened and what we were just discussing about the economy, even though there's an ambition for renewables to account for, you know, the bulk of growth in new power, coal is back to stay this year. Provincial governments will use the stimulus needs and the security and stability needs to approve new coal-fired power plants. And that complicates the long-term programs and the long-term plans.
Okay. Now, the plan itself gives some targets for production and emissions reductions, but it's silent on kind of other areas, as indeed have the other plans been. So what do these targets in the plan mean? How should we think about them? And perhaps in reality, are they forecasts or binding targets, or perhaps are they just meaningless? What do you think?
I mean, there's a huge amount of commentary on the targets, on the plans, and we as analysts, certainly in the West, love to look at them and say, these are the targets, and then we can use them to underpin various forecasts and look at what they mean for different, you know, fuels and the energy mix. I think we have to bear in mind again that this is these plans are the outcome of a long policy negotiation, right? Ministries draft them, they send them to industry, and that's usually state-owned enterprises in heavy industry and kind of the incumbents for comments. They send it to the provinces for comments. The plan is also a political show of the central government's ability to deliver. It's a domestic show and it's an international show. What China says, China can do. And therefore, sometimes the targets are not very ambitious, leaving room for them to be outdone. But it's also an evolving document. We've seen plans in the past where targets have not been met or they've been revised down. The gas plan, the 13th five-year plan for gas, is notable in that very few targets were actually met. Gas in the share of energy mix was revised down. Coal bed shale gas production was revised down. Sort of a lot of these things just didn't happen. But it does set the general direction of travel. It tells everybody in the bureaucracy, this is what we need to be aiming for. Obviously, the binding targets need to be met. And we've seen very quirky policy issues. You know, if you need to reach, and we talked about it at the end of last year with the power crisis, if you're not meeting your energy reduction targets, for instance, you just shut the lights off and then you try and meet those targets. Again, I think there's a recognition that that kind of signal is perhaps not best for managing a modern energy system. So they're not meaningless, but I think we have to take them with a pinch of salt and we have to see this plan as part of the kind of complicated political process and negotiation that has always been complicated in China. And when we're thinking about an energy transition, it's even more so.
And understanding and interpreting what kind of the messages coming from Beijing is absolutely key, which hopefully our listeners are able to get from not only the OIS's podcast, but also from the papers that you and your team write, Mikhail. What can we, something we talk about on podcasts quite often when we talk about China is technology and innovation, because a number of plans have been released, including storage, hydrogen, as well as technological innovation plans. So that's about my question, Mikhail, is what is the Chinese government hoping to achieve and what are some of the key points of the plan?
And we've had a flurry of plans issued just in the past sort of month or so with, again, as you say, a huge focus on technology and innovation. And as we've argued before, the energy transition in China is not a climate awakening by the Chinese leadership. They have long been aware of the risks and challenges associated with climate change. Historically, limiting local air pollution has been a higher priority. The shift to sort of climate action has been informed by a number of priorities, including energy security and food security, and of course the fact that there are more extreme weather events that impact food security and are obviously climate related has raised the urgency to tackle it. But there's also a very strong industrial component. Not only is the energy transition an opportunity to create new industries, to drive new growth, to change China's economic and industrial structure, to become competitive, and it already is very dominant in a number of new energy processes and materials. But I think there's also a perception that it could be a liability. the Chinese industry is not fit for purpose in a carbon-conscious world, China will no longer be central to global supply chains. And in the state of the world, where there are concerns about technological decoupling, where we're seeing the world bifurcated, especially now, following the Russian invasion of Ukraine, China has to cement its dominance. And part of that is going through industrial leadership and innovation. And so I think all these plans really highlight that issue, right? The 14th five-year plan talks about innovation and the Internet of Things and digitization of energy processes, but again, also innovation in specific areas. Hydrogen plan is the first time that we're getting a hydrogen plan in China. And that's on one hand, again, to give us a general direction of travel, because lots of different provinces are doing lots of different things, and to try and actually prevent overinvestments and an overheating in that sector. We've seen that with renewables. We've seen it with battery technologies, where lots of investments have been not necessarily the most efficient, where we've had subsidies being sort of wasteful, and that's a waste of central government budget. So really, on one hand, trying to focus, but also on the other hand, trying to give this message that, you know, innovate, innovate, innovate. And China has historically been scale-up nation, right? Taking a lot of foreign innovation, scaling it up. It now wants to lead innovation and design, but in an orderly fashion. But clearly the government is hitting all these points of storage, hydrogen as the key enablers for the energy transition. And again, the fact that we have a plan that talks about technological innovation for energy is very, very interesting and noteworthy. They are relatively low on specific targets, but again, it goes back to what we've just been saying. The idea here is perhaps to be less prescriptive, because that these targets can also lead to some distortion in the implementation and in the outcomes.
So, Mikhail, therefore, what are the main challenges you see in actually achieving some of these plans?
I mean, I think, and you know, we discussed this in a very long paper that we produced in December called "The Hardware versus Software," and sort of how the governance of China helps and hinders the energy transition. This centralized governance model and the fact that the government issues mandates and incentives does help to mobilize resources. It does, as I've just been saying, help to give the general direction of travel, to tell industry what it needs to focus on. You know, on innovation, the SASAC, which is the state-owned company or the state-owned entity that basically manages all state-owned companies, has just had a meeting in which it has told the SOEs that they need to lead innovation and collaborate with universities. I mean, the Chinese system has historically been very siloed. The energy system has been very siloed. And part of the challenge of the energy transition is really developing that software of overcoming those silos of market forces that will enable renewable integration in the grid. Those remain, I think, the core challenges. China is good at building hardware, right? It can mobilize resources and develop electrolyzers and develop new battery technologies, build a massive grid, long distance grids. But it needs to again break down the provincial barriers, the industrial barriers, and try to move the energy transition in that direction. These plans start to allude to some of those issues when they talk about the need for greater collaboration between provinces, market mechanisms. But can really the system change so fundamentally? Can governance methods, can these questions of central government and local governments, can they be fundamentally altered from the top down? I think those are some of the challenges that are inherent in the plan. And it doesn't mean that China can't make huge progress on adding new infrastructure, on creating new technologies, scaling them up, reducing the costs and commercializing things that will be useful for the energy transition writ large. But some of the changes probably require some sort of institutional transformation that I think will be harder to achieve.
So, Mikhail, as we kind of get to the end of this podcast, can we kind of in the last question kind of look forward and actually talk about the role of the market versus the state in the making of China's energy policy, which I know is a subject which we talk about often in our research at Oxford and indeed in our podcast. So I think my question is, do these Chinese plans and the latest documents give us any new indication of the direction of travel in China?
The short answer is yes and no, right? But the direction of travel that we've received from a lot of these documents is that markets need to play a decisive role in resource allocation. And that's something that the government and the party have been talking about for a decade now. And they are doing it gradually. But I think we have to bear in mind that the market cannot be the be-all and end-all, and it will not be the sole determining factor of sort of outcomes in China. These plans, I think similarly, they talk about the importance of markets, of unified markets, of transparent markets. I mean, if anything, the availability of data and transparency has become a thornier issue in China, certainly for foreigners to gain access to data, but also for the government. I think some of the plans and the guidances that have been issued really point to the need to benchmark and therefore gain access to very fundamental data in order to be able to build on that. So we are getting a bit more of, you know, plus ça change, you know, the more it changes, the more it stays the same. There is this desire to have markets drive some of the efficiency, but not lead all of the outcomes. And we're seeing it again in these documents. You know, just in early April, the government issued a paper guidance talking about accelerating the building of a unified national market. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean more market mechanisms. It just means that the central government should guide the market in a much clearer fashion. Again, we saw last year with the energy crisis that some of the challenges were just mixed signals and a mismatch between what the central government was saying and local provincial governments were trying to do. So I think we probably have to look at the definition of market and how it is perceived in China. I think, again, these plans highlight the importance of some market mechanisms, of more efficiency in allocating resources. But the perennial conflict is that the party and the state still want to have the ultimate control over outcomes, and that will not be left to the market.
Well, Mikhail, you know, again, thank you so much for your time and your insights today. And as always, I, you know, really enjoyed our conversation. It certainly builds on the messages from the Institute's recent China Energy Brief. Now, if any of our listeners will be interested in joining the OIS China program and receiving the China Energy Brief, as well as other benefits, please feel free to contact Mikhail Maiden at the Institute. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.